This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Happy Mother's Day. It's good to be back with Second Look after a couple weeks off. We've got a lot to cover in the next half hour, including a deep look by Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman into the state's parole system. Also, WMRA's own Britt Moorer brings us the scene and the sounds of the traffic jam sessions at the Music Resource Center, making life a little more melodic for drivers stuck in traffic in downtown Charlottesville. But first, more than 1,000 people from 27 congregations came together last Tuesday for the 10th annual Nehemiah Action Assembly, hosted by Impact. Each year, the group chooses a social issue affecting the greater Charlottesville community and devises an action plan to tackle the problem. As WMRA's Sefe Imakpai reports, this year's focus is on two issues: drug and alcohol abuse recovery in women and care for the elderly.
How are we going to change Charlottesville?
It was a full house at the annual Impact meeting in Charlottesville. Impact, which stands for Interfaith Movement Promoting Action by Congregations Together, is an organization made up of members who have made it their mission to tackle social issues in the community and seek change. Daniel Shisto is vice president.
This annual meeting is the largest public meeting in Charlottesville. It happens once a year, and it's the culmination of all of our efforts.
Throughout the year, members research a problem and seek out help from the decision makers within the community to address the issue in a specific way.
We asked the city and county if they would help with a residential treatment facility for women here in Charlottesville because none exists, and all six of them said yes.
Will you support it?
Yes, I will.
Several members of Charlottesville City Council and the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors promised to support the allocation of $75,000 to the construction of a new treatment center for women battling alcohol and substance abuse. Liz Emery is co-pastor of New Beginnings Christian Community and co-chair of Impact's strategy team for the residential treatment center for women. She says women are often denied residential treatment, and the nearest facility is more than 70 miles away.
Often, there's not a single bed available in the entire state for women who need substance abuse treatment, and so they either commit suicide or go on drinking and drugging until they reach the end of the line. And this is of critical importance, especially because this drug treatment center for women will help with their children because they can have two children under the age of five with them. And we have a treatment center here for men, but nothing at all for women. So it's a matter of justice, not just mercy.
Emory's co-chair, Janie Podorowski, says helping these women stay closer to home can only benefit the community as a whole.
Having the women remain in the community, they'll be able to, as they go through treatment, be connected with other services. There'll be some job training services available. They'll have transportation services available. Previously, if they wanted residential treatment, they had to go to either Lynchburg or Culpeper. And that makes it so much more difficult coming back into the community because they're not connected with those things that they need to be.
In addition to the residential rehab center, Impact members have also made it their mission to improve the quality and cost of elder care in Charlottesville. Vicki Bravo is on Impact's Elder Care Research Committee.
The supports and services that are needed as people age in the long term are too expensive, whether it's services at home or in a residential setting. The cost of long-term care is 1.5 times the average income of people over 65.
She says caring for the elderly is not just a concern for older people.
It has many impacts on their families who are put in the position of having to take care of them, but probably also needing to work, and so they're stuck because they don't have a way to give adequate care to their parents. So it affects the working community, it affects families of seniors, it affects all of us.
Chip Sanders is also on the Elder Care Committee. He says although there's no concrete plan in place right now, the goal is to get the conversation started.
One of the things we discovered in our research visits is that information was missing on the elderly that are maybe eligible and not being served, or that have other issues. And so what we're asking is that the agencies that specifically deal with aging issues in our community work together, coordinate their efforts, seek out the data that is needed to define the problem, and then develop a plan to approach a solution.
Impact leaders say the group will continue to work together to create change for people in Charlottesville and surrounding areas, no matter race, gender, or religion. For WMRA News, I'm Sefe Amokpai.
The Music Resource Center in Charlottesville is bringing the music outside to the streets. On sunny days, students play for drivers stuck in traffic right in front of their building, hoping to get people interested in what's going on inside. It's part of an all-new concert series called Traffic Jam, and WMRA's Britt Moore has the story.
The Music Resource Center in Charlottesville is just steps away from the city's historic downtown mall, next door to a busy fire station, and a short distance from the University of Virginia. But for most people in the area, it just looks like a big old empty building.
Every day people drive by and they see these huge church doors shut.
And most likely don't want to find out what lies behind them. So
I thought it'd be a great idea. Hey, how are you? See, we have fans.
Supporters of a hidden musical space helping kids express themselves.
We provide all the equipment and resources needed for our artists to create their own music. With that being said, if they've wanted to record an album before and never have, we sit down with them and talk about songwriting and get them lessons and doing everything we can to, you know, help them achieve the goals that they're looking to achieve.
Ike Anderson grew up attending classes at the MRC and wants everyone to hear and see how music being made inside the building is changing lives.
I was always a fan of music, and music played a big deal in my house. No one was really a musician, but, you know, a girl listening to a lot of Barry White, Isaac Hayes, Michael Jackson, and one day I found out about Music Resource Center, and I joined, and that was it.
Anderson is now the membership coordinator for the nonprofit center, which celebrated its 20th anniversary last year. One day he thought to himself, why not bring the music outside of the huge church doors and play for drivers navigating around Avon Street, one of Charlottesville's busiest.
I was a very average, bad guitarist, and now I'm way better than most people.
Jude, a seventh grader, has been taking guitar lessons at the MRC since the beginning of the school year.
There are a lot of options, and like there are so many different styles that you can do on the same instrument, and I really like that.
But in order to support its mission to provide more students, such as Jude, the same space to explore their music in the future, the MRC needs to raise money and increase the decibels to get noticed. Hence, Anderson's idea to get students outside playing for drivers stuck in traffic, the ultimate traffic jam.
Traffic jam's cool. Traffic jam is cool. I came in this day and Ike here said, hey, traffic jam. And I didn't know what he meant. So I said, got more cars than a beach got sand. And he said, yeah, outside, play. And I said, oh yeah, cool, of course.
Traffic jam, got more cars than a beach got sand.
The Dave Matthews Band reference is fitting of a Charlottesville music crowd, but Adam Disbro, one of the MRC music teachers, says music is really about the fluidity, the feeling.
So when you stand out here on the street and play, people are just like, oh my gosh, music, and it's live, meaning it's being created right there in front of you, and that is an amazing art.
You got to have that outlet to express yourself, and music is a great way to do that. It's a universal language everyone gets, and I haven't met a kid that said they didn't like music.
And the kids and drivers seem to be enjoying the free shows.
Since we've done this, people have a better idea about what we're doing. They see kids out here playing music, and people love it. People call and they ask if we're going to do it. People are stopping and giving us money. We get a lot of people who pull over and ask, so what do you guys actually do?
Traffic jam sessions happen pretty randomly. Students come out with the sun and during some of the busier traffic times on Avon Street, playing for the crowd, hoping to get a little appreciation and attention. For WMRA News, I'm Britt Moore.
We're going to focus the rest of the show now on parole in Virginia. It's been more than 20 years since the state abolished parole, and over that time, the prison population has grown to more than 30,000 people. Just over 10% of them committed crimes before the law changed, so they're still eligible for parole. The state now spends more than $1 billion a year on prisons and correctional programs. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Houseman explores why so few of those eligible are getting out of prison, the makeup of the state parole board, and Governor McAuliffe's commission that's taking a look at reinstating parole in Virginia.
Charles Zellers grew up in a small town 2 hours south of Charlottesville. He turned 48 in prison this month after spending nearly half of his life locked up for killing a child. He insists the death was an accident, but his public defender talked him into a plea.
My attorney told me that if I come in here and I did everything I was supposed to do, I'd be out in 7 years. He just said that they had overwhelming evidence against me. I said, well, there ain't no evidence. You know, it's just my word against their word. You know, we've never had any dealings with the legal system.
Now he's something of an expert on the law, and he's afraid he'll never get out, although he claims to be a model prisoner.
I've changed a whole lot. I mean, I've gotten my GED since I've been in here. I got 2 vocational trades. I've learned how to operate a computer.
But the head of the parole board continues to judge him for his crime, describing Zellers as a most unsympathetic offender. And Virginia has the lowest rate in the nation when it comes to parole. Each year, about 3% of those who are eligible are released. The mission of Virginia's parole board is simple, stated in bold on its website, to grant parole to those offenders whose release is compatible with public safety. In fact, it's a lot more complicated than that.
The parole board considers, among other things, the offender's history, physical and mental condition, character and conduct, employment and attitude while in prison.
That's actress Katie Gary. She agreed to read written answers to our questions after Parole Board Chairman Karen Brown declined to be recorded. Brown wrote that board members meet to discuss some cases but decide many others independently. Criminal defense attorney Steve Rosenfield thinks that's a shame.
You would think that a collaborative process would help. Somebody might change somebody else's mind, either for or against a prisoner, but to hear somebody's argument about why we should or should not release somebody seems to make the most sense.
A prisoner must get 3 of the 5 votes to be released, or 4 out of 5 if the conviction was for murder and the sentence life. While inmates may speak with a single member of the board, they never get a chance to address the whole panel in person. Charles Zellers is serving a life sentence plus 40 years for murder.
We don't see the parole board. We see just the interviewer. He types it in, and then he takes it back to the board members.
No matter what they say, inmates are often told they will not be paroled because of the seriousness of their crime, a factor they cannot change. Earlier this year, more than 40 prisoners staged a protest at the Augusta Correctional Center, refusing to speak with the interviewer and explaining their frustration to counselor and clergyman Harvey Yoder.
We're not going to go through what is basically a farce to be told the same thing over and over again.
On the other hand, people who want inmates released can address the board, and so can victims of a crime. That fact may bias the outcome of a hearing, according to Kevin Wrights, a professor of law at the University of Minnesota, and a national expert on parole.
You know, and speaking with individual parole board members around the country, some of them are very candid. I remember there was one parole board member who said, look, I just have to be frank with you. If the victim is sitting right there in the room, it's very hard afterwards to say to that person, no, we're not going to give you what you want. We're going to release the person.
The prisoner is not allowed to hear the victim's statement to correct any misinformation or explain circumstances. What's more, Karen Brown writes that she and other members of the board don't have to make sure claims are true.
The hearsay rules do not apply to board considerations. We often take into consideration recommendations, comments, and concerns made by third parties.
Parole board meetings are not open to the public, and documents pertaining to parole are not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. Professor Wrights thinks that, too, is a big problem.
It's just a travesty that the proceedings are not more transparent. A lot of parole boards use risk assessment instruments, but they won't show you how that instrument was scored in a particular case. The prisoner never sees it. The prisoner can't challenge it, but the public can't see it either. And this is how the length of a prison sentence is being decided.
The bottom line, he adds, is that parole board members are only answerable to the man who appointed them. There are five people on Virginia's parole board, all of them appointed by the governor. The chairman, Karen Brown, has a law degree from George Mason and was a prosecutor for 16 years. The other four members are a former public defender, a city councilman and corrections department veteran, a high school teacher and former state legislator, and a Baptist minister. Kevin Wrights thinks we could do better.
The original motto of the parole board is that this would be a group of experts who really knew something about human behavior and changing human behavior.
Wrights is a professor of law at the University of Minnesota and a national expert on parole. He thinks board members, who make up to $125,000 a year, should have very specific credentials and, once appointed, should be empowered to do their jobs without fear. Instead, they can be fired by the governor for any reason.
There is a feeling that if I let this person out today, and God forbid he or she goes on to do something terrible, then that's on me. On the other hand, if I make the cautious decision and keep the person in, then there's no risk to me. They have a reasonably nice job, but if they make a mistake and let the wrong person out, that job could be gone tomorrow.
The board uses a system for scoring people who are up for parole, and Wright says one such tool has proven very effective here in Virginia.
The Sentencing Commission has a risk assessment instrument that it gives to judges, and it has distilled the important risk factors for nonviolent crimes down to a list of about 7 or 8. It's a one-page form, and primarily it's some information about the current offense, a lot of information about prior criminal history, age and gender. It's not a long list of factors that can at least sort people into rough categories.
Those in the low-risk category are diverted from prison to treatment programs or community service. And over a 10-year period, Wright says not one has gotten into serious trouble again. Age alone is a good predictor of how likely a person is to commit another crime, according to mental health professionals like Harvey Yoder, a counselor and clergyman from Harrisonburg.
I'm just about to do a blog with photos of 22 men from a Virginia prison who were incarcerated as teens from ages 13 to 19. The difference, even in just brain development, of someone who is in his 50s or 60s and a teenager is vast. You know, the behavior that they exhibit at one stage in life doesn't necessarily carry over into the rest of their life.
Yoder says you can also predict who will go straight, in part, by looking at a person's conduct behind bars.
If any environment ever would test someone as to whether they're going to go in a responsible direction or become ever more criminal, it would be a prison. It's the kind of environment that is far worse than the worst neighborhood that any of these men come from.
But the board may not be giving much weight to any of these things. There are about 1,000 inmates eligible for parole because they're over the age of 60 and have served a certain amount of time. Some have been model prisoners, but last year, only 3% were freed. Joaquin Rodriguez came to this country from El Salvador when he was 15. He was excited to be in a place that offered freedom and opportunity, but 3 years later, his American dream turned into a nightmare when he was arrested and charged with 3 counts of armed robbery in Fairfax and Arlington, possession of a firearm, and malicious wounding.
They didn't have no evidence, no fingerprints, no videos. So I thought they would never convict me of anything.
What they did have was witnesses who identified him in a lineup. The Innocence Project reports witness error is the single biggest cause of wrongful conviction.
They took me to a lineup, and I was the only person that fitted the descriptions that the victim gave to the police and investigators. I was the only 18-year-old kid, you know, Hispanic, and my height and everything, everybody else. They were older men, they were police officers.
The prosecutor tried to make a deal, one that would mean as little as 10 years behind bars. But Rodriguez insisted he was innocent, and he had 2 lawyers to help him in court.
Both of them had just finished law school. They were committing a lot of mistakes. Even the judge will tell them, you can't do this, you can't do that. I already told you about this. They were very inexperienced, and you can't expect much from them, you know.
In the end, he got a sentence of 108 years. In part because Virginia imposes longer sentences each time someone is convicted of a violent crime. Here's former U.S. Attorney Tim Hafey.
A residential burglary was classified by the General Assembly as a violent crime. If you have a burglary conviction, then that triggers these enhancements of sentences for subsequent offenses.
Virginia also has a three strikes law intended to discourage criminals from committing new crimes once released from prison. Under that law, someone who's convicted of three felonies is ineligible for parole. Experts say three strikes laws have not prevented people from committing new crimes, but they have increased prison populations and costs dramatically. And they're unevenly applied. Rodriguez, for example, had never served time in prison before being locked up for all three felonies, and he was actually considered for parole several times before being told he was not eligible. Now he has little hope of release.
Pretty much growing old. I send clemency petitions to the governor every year, but I'm still here.
The commission set up to consider reinstating parole was concerned about people like Rodriguez and has called on the state to review all cases involving inmates convicted of three felonies. The panel also recommended getting rid of mandatory minimum sentences so judges have more flexibility in assessing each case. It called for sentence reductions for drug offenders who take part in treatment programs and an expansion of special drug courts, which sentence addicts not to prison, but to rehab. Again, former federal prosecutor Tim Hafey.
To get a drug court, it needs General Assembly or Supreme Court approval. And believe it or not, even in 2016, there are legislators that don't think drug courts work. That, to me, is crazy. Drug courts definitely work. They help each other. There's a peer dynamic that sets in. And the benefit that's at the end is if they're serious about curing their addiction, then the case goes away.
Such programs are expensive, but Hafey and others argue that Virginia could save a lot of money by taking people out of costly prisons and putting them in community-based programs. I'm Sandy Houseman.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. You'll find all of our stories from the newsroom at the website, too. Be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.